This is Paul Burnett interviewing Professor John Murphy for the Global Mining and Materials Research Project of the Business Series, the Oral History Center of the Bancroft Library. And we're here at the Denver Convention Center for the SME Gathering, and it's February 18th, 2015, and this is audio file one. So Professor Murphy, can you tell me a little bit about your family background and early years?
Well, I was raised in Pittsburgh. Always had an interest in technology. Got a BS in engineering from the University of Pittsburgh and an MBA from Duquesne University.
Mm-hmm. And your parents, your family background, where did what were they doing? What was their occupation?
My father was a registrar at Duquesne University. And my mother was an elementary school teacher.
Mm-hmm. And how did you first become interested in engineering? What was the spark for you?
I think from an early age, I always liked to take things apart, put things back together, devise new techniques and technology. Mm-hmm. And I liked the hands-on approach that these technologies and opportunities provided.
Mm-hmm. And so you started at University of Pittsburgh in 1957. That's kind of the Sputnik era. There's this enthusiasm around science and technology. Was that part of it? Was it just in the air at the time?
Yeah, but it certainly was before that in terms of my really grade school interest in science and technology.
Mm-hmm. Did you have did they have kits and things like that, like radio sets and things like that? Were you interested?
There were some. Heathkit was one of the opportunities in those early days to put things together and build devices and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And that was something that you were enthusiastic about. So you finished your Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering to the early 1960s. What did you do as your first occupation?
Actually, I went to work for the U.S. Bureau of Mines in the area of instrument development and instrumentation.
And what kind of instrumentation were you working on?
My early work was involved in actually monitoring noise and using meteorological conditions to predict the noise effects from blasting operations.
So you'd measure the decibels in a chamber, that kind of thing?
No, basically this was the interest was to actually predict the occurrence of blast noise off-site from a blasting operation.
Okay.
As a function of temperature inversions, wind and weather conditions, and so forth.
Wow. And the interest in this work that the U.S. Bureau of Mines was doing, was that the result of pressure from were people complaining about noise, and what was being
the initial interest was actually in terms of the effects of activities at the research center itself.
Okay.
That had a high propensity of activity in fires, explosions, and explosives research. As perhaps you know, the Bureau of Mines was really formed based on mine disasters. Mm-hmm. And the initial focus was fires and explosions. And so there was a lot of work at Pittsburgh related to identifying ways to prevent and minimize the consequences of fires and explosions in the underground and in the surface mines as well.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the, can you talk a little bit about some of the research and technologies that were developed either in the U.S. Bureau of Mines or associated with the Bureau of Mines? That assisted in mitigating disasters, mining disasters, and so forth?
Yeah, there's a host of answers to that question. So there's preventative measures and post-incident measures as well. Mm. From a fire and explosion perspective, there was work on various types of active and passive suppression systems, ranging from improvements in rock dusting or stone dusting, showing very clearly the effects of what's called float coal dust, and the fact that very thin layers of float coal dust can be levitated by very weak explosions and cause some very devastating events to various types of active suppression systems. For example, attempting to minimize the ignition at a working face. There was work on various types of urethane coatings that let me back up.
Sure.
So urethane coatings came into existence to prevent the weathering of shales that are found in many coal measure strata. And while they were effective in terms of preventing the weathering deterioration of them and hence roof fall hazards, in some cases these were fire hazards and you could get flash fires as a result. So there was a lot of work in terms of identifying those problems, assessing different types of urethane foams and so forth.
The urethane foam itself was a fire hazard.
Yeah. And what's interesting about that is that even if you look at some of the standard NSTA and NFPA characterization tests, the foams would show as being safe. But if you had big enough surface areas, like the entire cross-section of a mine roadway or tunnel, they turned out to give different results. And some of these problems have been manifested even in other industries, like some of the space shuttle disasters, where they had evaluated, for example, Velcro.
Mm-hmm.
And the launch pad accident where Grissom, Chaffee, and White died on the launch pad, it was basically a Velcro burning in an oxygen-rich atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they had evaluated this in a standard test, but if you change the incline of the test sample, you got highly increased propagation rates.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these means of evaluating materials from a flammability viewpoint is very sensitive to the environment and the scale in which it's being used.
Right, right. So something that is safe at a certain size or volume, it changes dramatically.
Or geometry,
right, yeah. Angle of incline. And just to back up further with some of these, if you're talking about coal mining, you talked about the levitation of coal dust. I mean, this basic problem is that it's this flammable substance, and when the dust is unsettled or comes into the air, it's brought in contact with oxygen or surrounded by oxygen, and then a spark from work can ignite it. Is that kind of one of the scenarios for fires?
Well, the typical scenario is as follows. You, in the course of cutting coal, particularly with mechanized mining techniques, you create dust. There is a fraction of dust that is aerodynamically transportable. There's a smaller fraction of that which is respirable, which causes a pneumoconiosis problem.
Right.
But for the dust that's transportable, again, typically referred to as float dust, the dust can be transported and it'll settle on surfaces.
Mm-hmm.
The standard strategy in most countries around the world is that you apply quantities of limestone or rock dust to inert the coal dust.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some specifications in terms of the percent of inert or rock dust that is required to ensure that there's no propagation of the dust explosion. So the scenario is that if you have some mechanism, I'll come back to the mechanism in a moment, if you have some mechanism to levitate the settled coal dust that is then ignited, it creates a little poof, so to speak, and that poof levitates some more coal dust, which makes a bigger poof, and it sort of bootstraps itself along to the point that you have some major event. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the typical initiation mechanism, it's generally a small pocket of methane air mixture at the face that is ignited, for example, a frictional spark from a tungsten carbide cutting bit hitting some sandstone or a rock and so forth. And then that a little weak ignition again levitates some settled float coal dust, and it gets this bootstrap phenomenon that moves along. Mm.
And were there some significant historic mine disasters and fires that really spurred this kind of research forward? Was there
There's a whole host of them that goes back to the formation of the Bureau of Mines was based on that type of an event. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure whether it fits your particular format, but there's a very illustrative graphic that the Bureau of Mines has prepared, actually NIOSH prepared, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Bureau of Mines, that lists all these disasters and lists the advanced technology advances that were implemented as a result of that. Mm. And I can share it with you if you have an interest.
That would be great. Well, we could actually get a copy of it and put it in the oral history, perhaps.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be really...
I can email that to you.
Absolutely illustrative, yeah. And so during your time there in the 1960s, you were doing work on, you were an electrical research engineer starting in 1965.
61.
In 61. And, oh, okay.
61.
Great. 61 to 67. Yeah.
Yeah, that just lists various areas of interest and responsibility and
right.
progressing through
the ranks.
Yeah.
And during that time, you were doing work on explosives research. Is that what you were discussing just now?
Yes.
Okay. And in this is again in 1967 to 1970. You were doing the development of instrumentation systems, and this is the kind of stuff that you were talking about. The definition of performance of large-scale gas and condensed detonations.
So that's that was some basic science work that I and some of my colleagues were involved in terms of trying to understand some fundamentals of explosion mechanisms and techniques to suppress them and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And you had done, it says you'd done your own research on noise instrumentation and gas detonation systems that were you just following your own curiosity at that point?
They were team efforts, but we were investigating various hypotheses as it relates to those particular areas.
Mm-hmm. And pumpable slurry explosive systems. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Certainly.
Kind of research?
So, one of the innovations in explosives, both for construction as well as for mining, particularly surface mining, was the introduction of ammonium nitrate fuel oil. And ammonium nitrate fuel oil was a completely different strategy to using dynamites, which go back to the beginning of time.
Sure.
And so ammonium nitrate fuel oil has a variety of advantages and some disadvantages. The advantages are principally cost and the ability to bulk load boreholes. Some of the disadvantages are that it's not water repellent. And in the case of underground mines, there's an issue called permissibility, which I'll come back to in a minute.
Sure.
So we were involved in looking at a variety of formulations of explosive material that were emulsified mixtures that could be cross-linked and are water repellent, mm-hmm. that could be used in some of these applications. Mm-hmm. In terms of underground mines, particularly coal mines or any gassy mine where explosives are used, there is this permissibility requirement. And basically there's a series of assessments or evaluations that are used to assess whether an explosive is configured in a manner that will not cause the following scenario to happen. Mm-hmm. And the scenario is that you have a borehole which has explosives in it that typically results in some cases in what's called a blown out shot.
Okay. And a blown out shot.
Blown out shot.
Okay.
So instead of the explosive fragmenting the coal or the rock, it basically it doesn't yield. It just shoots out the material like a cannon, shooting out of a cannon.
Right.
And as a result of that, you have hot combustion products that would likely ignite a methane air mixture if it were present at the face where this activity was taking place. And so there's various strategies, whether you're using dynamite or whether you're using some other type of formulation, to keep the combustion products cool enough that it would not ignite a gas air mixture if it were present. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the evaluation criteria is to load a quantity of this explosive, this test explosive, in a steel cannon and fire it into a gas air mixture and statistically determine the 50% point where you could ignite the gas air mixture. And there's thresholds that need to be maintained or met in order to be, quote, proved as a permissible explosive.
Right. So this blown out shot scenario is kind of a worst case scenario, a perfect storm of events that
exactly.
would precipitate a disaster. And it was a known thing. It had happened. And they determined that this had caused disasters in the past. And so this was the kind of nightmare scenario.
It's a known phenomenon.
Yeah. And so you want to figure out ways to make the explosives themselves to have a kind of chemical structure that is, and a physical structure, right, presumably, sufficient to prevent it from
That's
happening.
Correct. It would still do the work it's expected
right,
to do.
Right, right.
Now, the other part of this recipe is that both for performance as well as for safety, there's what's called stemming, which is an inert material like clay that's inserted into the borehole after the explosives are inserted. Mm-hmm. And so stemming is important in terms of, again, assuring that the, quote, approved or permissible explosive works effectively as well as safely.
Right, right. Yeah, what comes to mind is, I know very little about underground mining blasting, but shaped charges, is that something that evolved over time to so the blast goes only in one direction? Is that a kind of shaped charge? Or
no, basically, I've had some experience with shaped charges, and in fact, it's a bit of a digression, but one of the interesting phenomena is what's called linear shaped charge. Mm-hmm. Which is used to, for example, cut holes in tanks and launch vehicles and this type of thing.
Right.
But an explosive does what it's supposed to do by two phenomena. One is the shock pressure, and second is what's called the heaving capability. Mm. So one of the ways that we used to evaluate various types of candidate explosive systems is to actually fire them in a pond underwater, because you can easily measure the peak blast pressure as well as the decay envelope afterwards. And so depending on what you wanted to do with the explosive to do, you may want peak shock pressure, and you didn't care about the following shape of the pressure wave.
Right.
In some cases, if you wanted to heave, you may not need much shock pressure, but you want a lot of heaving capability afterwards.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. As you're talking about this, I'm thinking about synergies with other kinds of endeavors, and I wondered if the U.S. Bureau of Mines had contact with the Department of Defense or the Aberdeen Proving Ground on, because they're interested in explosives too for different reasons, but was there any cross-fertilization of experimentation or results?
There's an incredible amount. In fact, I believe I worked for every federal agency on various fires and explosions and explosive issues while working for the Bureau of Mines.
Mm-hmm.
And
so not just defense, but other...
Defense worked for some of the NASA problems, launch vehicle problems. One of the projects that comes to mind is that myself and a team of colleagues worked with others in the evaluating the destruct system for the Titan II launch vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because the Titan II is a hypergolic propulsion system. It uses a liquid fuel and a liquid oxidizer, which burns spontaneously when they're mixed together.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you launch a vehicle from Vandenberg or from the Cape, there is a range safety officer that is sitting there with the big red button that is responsible for destroying the vehicle if it goes astray.
Mm-hmm.
And because they had never launched a hypergolic propulsion system before, we actually were involved in running half linear scale tests on a first stage of a Titan II launch vehicle.
At your facility?
No, we actually did the work out here near Denver, Lowry Air Force Bombing Range.
Interesting. And it's hypergolic?
Hypergolic.
Okay.
H-Y-P-E-R-G-O-L-I-C.
Wow. Okay, so there are sort of, your expertise in explosives can be deployed in a number of different areas and was deployed in a number of different areas.
It certainly was.
Yeah. And that must have been pretty exciting work to go into these different domains. And
yeah, it's we had a lot of core competencies.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of unique facilities. And as a result of that, we were asked to contribute to a host of different activities and initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of unique tools, for example, we had a high-speed movie camera that would take 1.2 million frames a second. And in that era, that was super high speed. Today, there's faster camera systems, but... you could actually look at initiation mechanisms for explosives.
Right.
And it was a very useful tool amongst others that we had.
In the crucial microseconds after a detonation, you can film that.
Well, actually, yeah, you could film that. In fact, you could film it before the initiation. Mm-hmm. And an example is that there was a team at the Bureau of Mines that identified some interesting initiation mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the stories is that back in the 70s, there was a large increase in the use of nitromethane. And nitromethane had been shipped in 55-gallon drums, and because of the increase in volume, and it was being shipped in railroad tank cars.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a number of incidents where a railroad tank car when it was going through the so-called shunting process, where they make up trains on sidings.
Yeah.
And they push a car up a little hill, and then it slides down. They set all the switches so it winds up in train number 10 or train number 11.
It kind of slams into it a little bit.
It slams into. Yeah. So in a couple of these slamming incidents, the tank car detonated.
Wow.
And so the question was, how could that happen? Mm-hmm. And there are standard tests to evaluate the shock sensitivity of materials. Mm-hmm. And using those standard tests, it was impossible to get nitromethane to detonate with the types of pressures, shock pressures, that you could ever envision having in a shunting type incident. And what happens is that if you cavitate the liquid, like you would when you're sloshing the material around, mm-hmm. you get micro-initiation sites mm-hmm. in the bubbles that are the vapor nitromethane. Mm-hmm. And they turn out to be the initiation sites that then propagate into a full-scale event. Mm-hmm. And again, using high-speed photography, we were able to actually visually show this particular phenomenon.
Wow, that's fantastic. I guess some nitromethane was thought to be much more inert prior to that, and
it was demonstrated to be inert by standard shock sensitivity.
Right,
inert's the wrong word.
Okay,
it was demonstrated to be less sensitive than it turned out to be.
Right,
due to the fact that the cavitation actually reduced the sensitivity by a couple orders of magnitude.
So the old, have in mind, you know, those miners with their boxes of nitroglycerin packed in sawdust, and I'm thinking of that level of sensitivity. But according to the tests in nitromethane, it was thought to be fine, and then they found that there was this particular kind of agitation of the liquid that created.
If you cavitate it, if you put essentially bubbles in it, and you weakly shock the bubbles, they turn out to be initiation sites that lets the reaction move forward.
Wow. So in terms of work practice, this sounds like an experimental laboratory, that you're modeling these kinds of scenarios using at different scales, using different kinds of criteria. So it sounds like you're getting feedback from the outside world. There's an incident that happens, and you try to recreate those parameters to figure out what's the missing piece.
Yeah, we did this for a variety of activities and needs. We were involved with the Department of Transportation in terms of characterization of the safe storage, safe transport, and handling of various types of reactive materials. Mm-hmm. I mentioned ammonium nitrate before. Yeah. There was a number of infamous incidents, like the Texas City explosion of ammonium nitrate.
Yeah.
And again, using some of the standard safety characterization tests, ammonium nitrate appeared to be relatively inert. Yet it was known that there was Texas City, which there was a major disaster, and there were others as well. Mm-hmm. And so the National Fire Protection Association was interested in determining more realistically the safe storage distances for ammonium nitrate and ammonium nitrate fuel oil. And the fire marshals of the United States said, unless you can prove to us quantitatively that there is this is less hazardous than dynamite, we're going to require that it be stored by what's called the American Table of Distances, mm-hmm. which is basically says if you have X pounds of explosives here, You got to have Y feet before you can have X pounds of explosives here. Right. And if you stored ammonium nitrate per the dynamite classification, it would take huge amounts of acreage. So the question was, let me back up.
Sure.
There is a phenomenon that's called the critical diameter of explosive materials. And so for dynamite, the critical diameter is, depending on the particular dynamite, is a fraction of an inch. For nitroglycerin, it's millimeters. And it turns out that for ammonium nitrate, in its typical prill formulation, it's on the order of 20 or 30 inches. Mm-hmm. And so if you run experiments, shock sensitivity experiments, with the standard tests that maybe are 2 to 4 inches in diameter, ammonium nitrate looks very, very safe and very innocent.
Right.
If you run it in diameters, say on the order of 60 inches, you get completely different results. Mm-hmm. And so for an experiment, a series of experiments that was actually funded by the Manufacturing Chemists Association, we actually ran some large-scale experiments using up to 60-inch diameter charges. And so there was a charge called the donor, which was purposely initiated, and there was a charge called the acceptor, which was then looked
distance,
at
yeah.
And determined essentially statistically determined the 50% point where you would get go, no go.
Right.
And if you go out 3 sigma, you can determine the point where 99% probability you would not have an ignition.
Right.
And so that was another example of using some of these core competencies and skills to address another national interest and national need.
Did that result in different storage requirements?
It did.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. This is for this has applications for farms and other things as well, right?
Yeah, but in terms of storing large quantities, it's basically a distribution system for large projects.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of farms where you might have just a relatively small quantity, it's still important to have that understanding and that data, but it's not having massive quantities of the material on hand.
Mm-hmm. So you're doing experiments and you've talked about statistical analysis. Can you talk a little bit about tools that you used, including computing power in the in the 60s and 70s, and how that evolved in terms of the work that you were doing?
Well, so there's two sets of answers that come to mind relative to this. In terms of the fires and explosions work, over the course of the years, the team developed a variety of pretty unique tools. For example, one of the matters of interest is the detonation velocity in a material that's going to detonate or explode. Mm-hmm. And the standard classical technique was that you put a probe at point X and a probe at point Y, and you measure the time between the activation of probe 1 and probe 2. And using a typical time interval meter, you could calculate the detonation velocity.
Mm-hmm.
One of the phenomena that was of particular interest was typically referred to as a DDT, a deflagration to detonation transition. Mm-hmm. And deflagration being a subsonic reaction, and detonation being a supersonic reaction. So the team developed some continuous velocity probes that would actually measure continuously the propagation rate over the entire course of the event.
Mm.
There were also devices developed that obviously had to be expendable,
mm-hmm.
To measure detonation pressure, shock pressure, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a variety of tools and techniques like that. I mentioned the high-speed cameras and so forth. Mm-hmm. In a broader sense, if you look at for example, the Coal Mine Health and Safety Act of 1969, mm-hmm. Provided a lot of responsibilities, provided a lot of funding. There were lots of opportunities to address various needs via the use of computer technology. Mm-hmm. One that comes to mind is mine monitoring systems. Mm-hmm. And so, excuse me, there was identified a need to try to assess on a continuous basis various parameters in an underground mine. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, computer technology, telemetry, and the like came into play in that particular regard. What's interesting is that while the computer technology was important, probably the biggest challenge was in terms of devising, identifying, developing, and adapting instrumentation to monitor different parameters. Mm-hmm. So, for example, airflow is an important parameter, both in terms of the magnitude as well as the direction. Mm-hmm. And up to that point, the standard device for measuring airflow was the vane anemometer, which I'm sure you've seen, the little windmills.
Yeah, exactly.
And vane anemometers don't hold up very well in a mine environment when they're asked to work on a continuous 24/7 basis. Mm-hmm. So there was work with external collaborators in terms of ultrasonic devices, for example, that would measure airflow with both speed and direction. Mm-hmm. There was various types of studies to remove people from the face in terms of mining activities.
Right.
And so there was looking at various types of transducers that could identify, for example, the coal roof or the coal floor interface that could be used to assist either the operator at a remote location or, in the ultimate case, the some type of semi-automatic or automatic control of cutting machines and so forth.
There was
computer technology was important, but the transducers to feed the computers was probably even more challenging and equally important.
Right, right. I mean, as they say about computing garbage in, garbage out. So if you don't have the right data coming in,
right,
the computer is not going to be useful.
Right.
So you,
I mean, there are other cases where computer modeling was very effectively used. There was teams at the Bureau that developed various types of pillar design technologies, mm-hmm. using computer models and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And this was important in terms of ground control, roof stability, and this type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the transducers on the floor or the roof could detect instability? Is that some of the...
No, the ones I made reference to were basically, well, so if you have a coal seam that, for the sake of discussion, is 6 feet thick, mm-hmm. and you have adjacent strata on the top and on the bottom. In many cases, the bottom is clay, and so you want to cut to the clay, you don't want to cut through the clay.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps more importantly, what's on top, and you have, sometimes you have hard sandstone.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, you have shale, and so it's important to not disrupt the adjacent roof strata, mm-hmm. unless there's a design plan to remove it for some particular reason.
Right.
So the idea was, can you have some type of a measurement system that would tell the operator you are at or close to that horizon.
And so you did a lot of work on industrial hazards, the title that you had from 71 to 78 is Research Supervisor, Industrial Hazards and Communications.
Mm-hmm.
What's the communications part of that title?
That's an interesting topic because, on the surface, we take two-way communications for granted. You buy Motorola radios or RCA radios, and
right.
And as long as you have the proper antenna system, it works like it's supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Those particular devices don't work at all or don't work well underground. And the reason is that basically when you're in a set of mine entries or tunnels, you're effectively in a waveguide. And the waveguide does not support propagation of most of those frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a number of strategies that were identified to minimize or overcome some of those issues. First of all, you can either go very low frequency and get some beneficial results, and I'll come back to the pros and cons of that in a moment,
mm-hmm.
or you can go to extremely high frequencies and get some meaningful results.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, it was typically VHF frequencies at 150, 180 megahertz. You go around one corner in a coal mine and the radios won't work.
Right.
And you can go very low frequency. The principal problem is the antennas for very low frequency are typically large. They're not little whip antennas like you find on a handheld radio and
right.
so forth. You can go to very high frequencies and get some increased propagation, but you don't have long-range capabilities.
Mm.
So one of the systems that people have worked on is what's called leaky feeder systems, which are basically a coaxial cable that's got holes cut in the sheath, so it leaks, and you can leak signals out and you can leak signals in. And with proper design, you can get some fairly wide coverage. There was an extensive program, both from a theoretical perspective as well as a practical hardware perspective, identifying the capabilities and limitations of various types of radio systems and assessing them in terms of underground applications.
Mm-hmm.
One of the philosophies that we always worked on was that the best emergency communication system is an operational one which is effective. It's still effective in emergency or disaster mode.
Right.
And that way people have it, they're using it, they get daily benefit from it. And if you need an emergency situation, it's there and it's working as long as it still functions under some type of emergency condition.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at, for example, redundant paths
right.
for a leaky feeder
mm-hmm.
and this type of design.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of firms that sell various types of underground wireless communication system that in some part were based on these types of studies that were done back in the 70s at
mm-hmm.
this point.
Mm-hmm. And as part of the redundancy, were there also wired communications through the tunnels?
There were always since back to the 50s at least, probably before, there were wired communications, mine phones,
mm-hmm.
And they certainly served a purpose, but when you have a vast expanse of underground mined out real estate,
mm-hmm.
They had limitations.
Yeah.
And so one of the issues, of course, is how do you notify people if there's some type of an incident in another part of the mine to alert them to take corrective action, to escape and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, there was interest in the wireless communications.
Mm-hmm.
There's also interest in wireless communications for mine rescue teams in terms of operating in those types of scenarios. Mm-hmm. And of course, when you talk about the application of these in an underground, potentially gassy mine, there was always the issue of intrinsic safety or so-called permissibility.
Right.
And so the devices had to be designed and configured to meet that particular requirement. And again, for some of the very low frequency systems with the large antennas, you could get enough stored energy in the loop antenna that under fault conditions it could potentially be an ignition source.
It could discharge as a kind of capacitor?
If you had enough stored energy in a coil, and the coil was disrupted by some type of an incident, you conceivably could have a spark that would ignite a gas-air mixture.
Mm-hmm.
So there had to be appropriate precautions in terms of how big the antenna was, how much energy was stored in it, and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine that, you know, if you want, whether it's high frequency or low frequency, if you want a better propagation, these would be higher voltage applications? Or
more higher power.
Higher power, like more current. Okay.
So in terms of a low frequency system, it's basically the amount of current you're pumping through a big loop antenna.
Mm-hmm.
And again, how much stored energy is in that coil or in that device.
Right, right. I mean, that's really challenging. That's some of the most probably, I imagine, frustrating and exciting work that an engineer can do is to have multiple conflicting parameters, right?
Oh, there's always trade-offs.
Yeah, yeah.
And in terms of the underground environment, there's extra trade-offs right. In terms of some of the things I just shared with you.
Right, right, absolutely. But it sounds like your researchers and your teams had positive results in developing these systems, or at least sort of laid the ground for future innovation.
Yeah, basically, in terms of the high-frequency systems, there were commercial devices that were available on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, there were efforts to adapt these to underground applications, both in terms of environmental conditions, the propagation issues with leaky feeder systems and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the low frequency systems, there weren't any commercially available devices, so there were some efforts to develop some prototypes and demonstrate that particular approach.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some companies that sell that kind of technology now.
Mm-hmm.
There was also interest and efforts to identify means to locate trapped miners.
Yeah.
And there were two basic approaches that were followed. One was a seismic system where miners who were trapped were instructed to follow a protocol in terms of banging a timber on a roof bolt, for example, or on the mine roof.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was with a set of seismometers on the surface, you could locate and triangulate the location.
Right.
And there was an emergency capability developed and maintained by the Mining Enforcement and Safety Administration.
Mm-hmm.
Based on that technology. Mm-hmm. There were also efforts to devise a system that used an electromagnetic location system.
Mm-hmm.
So again, using a very low frequency transmitter hooked to essentially a single coil wrapped around a coal pillar,
mm-hmm.
You could generate a magnetic field that you could detect on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a series of ways to assess the capability and limitations of that particular approach.
Mm-hmm.
Again, some of the limitations were the amount of power that you had available. You assumed that the only power that was available was the cap lamp battery.
Yeah.
And you also had the limitations in terms of how much power you could put into the into the antenna, in terms of the intrinsic safety issues I mentioned a moment
right.
ago.
Right.
And basically, with those particular limitations, the other important parameter was the electrical conductivity of the overburden. So it depends on, for example, how much salinity there was in the overburden,
right.
determine the propagation of the signal.
And so these are kind of transponder stations that you could miner could get to and plug into.
You could either have a transponder station, or because at that time it was difficult to predict where you might wind up. The idea was to have, since you had your cap lamp battery, you had if you had a coil, a roll of wire that you could essentially be the antenna, you could set it up wherever you wanted, wherever you find yourself to be.
Right.
And now, at that time, there was some studies on survival chambers, and there's even more recently, in some of the more current recent legislation, some additional requirements for survival chambers for miners.
Mm-hmm.
If you look here at the show, there's some people promoting their particular commercial versions of survival chambers for underground mines.
And this is getting into the late 70s. You're starting to work on an international collaboration and learn and disseminate this information. So the Bureau of Mines was not just for the United States, in other words. Right? This research was published, it's out there, and other countries could make use of it. Could you talk a little bit about how knowledge about mine safety and health circulated around the world?
Well, first of all, let me correct what you said.
Okay.
I submit to you the Bureau of Mines was for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The Bureau of Mines had much to learn from other countries, and the Bureau of Mines was willing to share information with other countries as well, particularly in regards to the disaster area. There are some similarities and there are some differences in the way mines are designed and operate in different countries, principally because of different strata, different depths of coal and so forth. And so there was a group that of the principal coal mining countries around the world that annually collaborated in terms of exchanging research results, and that was mutually beneficial in terms of the work that the Bureau did and the work that they did that was shared with our scientists and engineers as well. And so there were exchanges of technology, there was exchanges of devices and prototypes and so forth that was used to promote and enhance the health and safety of miners in the United States as well as other parts of the world as well.
Right. And also presumably American companies, once they adopt that as standard practice in the United States, wherever they're operating, it's something they would like to implement. If it's applicable, or if it's relevant.
If it's applicable, that's true.
Right. So now by the late 70s, now you're a research director, 1978 on through the 80s and into the 90s. You're handling a much bigger staff. This is now about 350 people are working with you, and you're handling sort of the bigger picture. Can you talk about that era a little bit and some of the challenges that the Bureau of Mines was facing and how the Bureau of Mines managed requests and helped the mining industry?
I'd characterize as challenges and opportunities.
Yeah.
The opportunities to have the resources to invest in looking at a variety of issues and needs was actually an exciting time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you looked at the mining program, the mining program of the Bureau of Mines, it basically was managed and implemented by four research centers.
Mm-hmm.
There was Pittsburgh, Minneapolis, Denver, and Spokane, Washington. And each of the centers had core competencies that were used to address particular needs. In some cases, those needs were a regional basis. in some cases because of some of the unique capabilities and facilities like fires and explosions. The vast majority of that was done in Pittsburgh, regardless of where the need was.
Right.
As I mentioned before, the Coal Mine Health and Safety Act of 1969, which, if I recall, is Public Law 91-173, provided some mandates and provided funding resources to address those needs. So we truly had a multidisciplinary team that was built and put together to work on particular problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was, for example, there was the ground control or strata control.
Mm-hmm.
There was the fires, explosions, and explosives. There was issues like life support for emergency escape and rescue activities.
Mm-hmm.
There was all the industrial hazards areas that you mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
And there were industrial hygiene issues in terms of diesel, for example, and problems with handling of other potentially toxic materials and so forth.
Right, right. I mean, an underground mine is it's an artificial ecosystem, right? You've got to support, it's got to support human life.
But to be clear,
yeah.
Some of these issues exist in surface mines as well.
And so did you do some work for open pit operations?
Yeah, for example, I mean, in terms of ground control, there's more problems in an underground mine and more needs, but there's slope stability problems, for example, in an open pit mine as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the issues of, for example, our colleagues at Twin Cities were very involved in the in visibility for large haulage vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you've seen the haul trucks that the tires are bigger than people.
Yeah, that's right.
And so there were and still continue to be incidents of people being injured and killed by an operator not being able to see somebody that's in the proximity of one of these vehicles.
Right.
So there were various studies in terms of looking at tools and techniques to deal with that kind of a problem.
Mm. I imagine today they have cameras all over the place that the operator can see in many
directions.
They
have cameras and mirrors and so forth.
Right,
and
right.
They also have some backup alarms and ultrasonic detectors and this type of thing as well.
Right. And in terms of slope stability, one of the dangers can be as the road that goes around the pit, you're hauling massive tonnage up these roads, and you can have problems with the cave-in of the road. Is that some of the kind of stuff that you worked on?
Yeah, you could essentially lose the high wall or the slope and have devastating effects, both in terms of the immediate health and safety issues, as well as the ability to get in and out of the pit and so forth.
Right, exactly. That's a real serious problem.
Right. Sure.
Yeah. And I imagine, please correct me if I'm wrong, but there's more open pit mining as time goes on because they develop sort of more profitable techniques for mining, or as opposed to underground, or is it just these are apples and oranges?
Well, the answer is you mine because there's a commodity that you can gain some economic benefit from.
Right.
And so you then, after you identify the ore body or the coal bed, whatever it might be, then you decide the most cost effective way to remove it.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of both ground control, slope stability, accessibility, materials handling, and so forth, you ultimately wind up with either an open pit mine or an underground mine. And for example, if it's an underground mine, then you have issues whether it's a slope where you get an incline that goes into the ore body or reserve,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a drift mine where you go in off a hillside,
mm-hmm.
Whether you have a shaft that goes down and then you develop the access from there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then there's different mining techniques that go from so-called room and pillar mining to longwall mining, which are the two predominant coal mining methods.
Mm-hmm.
in Trona, for example, which is a flat tabular, typically a flat tabular deposit is typically mined with room and pillar or longwall mining, mm-hmm. to where you have these massive deposits, where you have block caving, where you collapse the essentially the whole ore body into a cavity below.
Mm-hmm.
There's veins where you basically are chasing the vein with various tunnels and drifts and so forth.
Right, right.
So there's a whole both art and science in terms of how you choose the mine.
Right.
As a generalization, I would say my answer to your question is because the easy to find ore bodies have been more frequently found than not found, there's more of a trend toward more underground mining than there is surface mining.
Ah, okay. That's interesting. So it has to be much more targeted to go deeper.
Yeah.
As the new one that's being sunk in northern Arizona, that's starting off 1,600 feet deep, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think some of the deepest mines in this country are up in the Coeur d'Alene's. Hecla mine, for example, Lucky Friday mine.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those, they're well over a mile deep.
Right, right. So there continues to be a need for underground safety.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the problems will multiply as it gets hotter down there.
Gets hotter.
Yeah, ventilation problems.
You have more of a challenge pumping air in.
Yeah.
Pumping exhaust air back out.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, they actually have some of the deeper mines around the world. They actually use cooling stations to cool the air that they pump into the working area.
Right, right. And so you have to keep it safe and workable for humans.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
This is not a hospitable climate for people.
Oh, true.
Is there a particular research program that you are the most proud of, that was the most challenging, most interesting, and most rewarding for you personally?
I'm not sure there's a singular program because I think that the work that we did in a variety of areas is noteworthy. I'll share a few with you.
Mm-hmm.
We've predominantly focused on health and safety in this discussion so far, which mm-hmm. is certainly a priority one.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Bureau of Mines, there were efforts in a number of other areas. For example, there were some very successful programs in terms of treating acid mine drainage with passive treatment systems. There was work on subsidence prediction, subsidence control, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some basically mining technology programs that certainly had benefits in terms of health and safety, but were designed to improve mining extraction as another important aspect of the overall mining operation.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask what are some of the highlights of the program, we talked about communications. I think there were some very pioneering studies that defined the shape and the status of underground mine communications today.
Mm-hmm.
There was some pioneering studies that advanced the state of the art of self-contained self-rescuers.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to the Mine Health and Safety Act of 1969, there were so-called filter self-rescuers,
mm-hmm.
Which basically was a carbon monoxide filter.
Mm-hmm.
They were designed to remove carbon monoxide from the inspired air.
Right.
Their principal limitations were twofold. One was if you had too much carbon monoxide, it wouldn't remove it. The higher the carbon monoxide got, the hotter the inspired air became. And if there wasn't enough oxygen in the inspired air, it didn't matter whether you removed the carbon monoxide or not.
Right.
So the Health and Safety Act of 1969 mandated a self-contained self-rescuer. Mm-hmm. There was some initial work in that regard. There's been some improvements over the years in the intervening time since then. We made some major advances in the fires and explosions area in terms of particularly this float coal dust issue that
right.
I mentioned.
Sure.
There was some work started back then that has just recently come to fruition in terms of instrumentation to easily measure the incombustible content of a coal dust, rock dust mixture. And the old classical technique was that you basically took a sample and you took it to a lab and you got it analyzed. But that took days to get the results.
Right.
When you want to be able to respond essentially instantaneously to a potentially hazardous situation.
Right.
We initiated a program in ergonomics and human factors and human air, which prior to that time had not been addressed from a mine health and safety perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there were some major advances made, and NIOSH continues to pursue these types of areas and continues to make advances in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned ground control before. There was some major advances in ground control in terms of support systems, analysis techniques, and so forth,
mm-hmm.
that all were important in terms of improving mine health and safety.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very dynamic program in terms of methane control,
mm-hmm.
and particularly both in terms of localized methane control, and which from a localized viewpoint also goes into dust control, which I'll come back to in a minute,
mm-hmm.
and also techniques to pre-drain coal major strata of methane prior to mining.
Mm.
And in those particular days there was some emerging technology in terms of long-hole horizontal drilling.
Mm-hmm.
And so the teams that worked on that were able to drill holes over a mile long and stay in the coal seam,
hmm.
and after which point you essentially had a horizontal gas well,
yeah.
that you could pre-drain the methane prior to mining. So you minimized the amount of liberation that took place during the mining operation.
Right, right.
And there was also some collaborative work done with some of the mining companies in terms of so-called slant hole drilling,
mm-hmm.
Which is now being used very extensively for the Marcellus Shale type activities.
Mm.
So there was a lot of progress made, and it was used fairly extensively for preconditioning a coal bed for minimizing methane release.
Mm-hmm.
I started to mention respirable dust, and again, there's a lot of interest, a lot of focus on respirable dust,
mm-hmm.
Appropriately so because of the pneumoconiosis problem.
Yeah.
And so there are a host of strategies in terms of looking at minimizing dust generation, and also in terms of minimizing dust exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Those are actually two separable issues. If you prevent the dust being generated, you don't have to worry about the exposure.
Right.
But you can also have strategies where you can divert the dust away from miners, from equipment operators, and so
right.
forth.
Right.
And so, for example, there was a team at Brewston that developed some what I call micro ventilation techniques,
mm-hmm.
that could be mounted on a continuous miner,
mm.
using appropriately directed water sprays.
Mm.
And not, well, let me back up.
Mm-hmm.
So water sprays have been traditionally used to suppress dust.
Right.
And that does work to a point. But it was identified that if you can direct the sprays in certain orientations, you can create micro ventilation circuits mm-hmm. that divert the dust-laden air away from the miners.
Yeah.
And so that was a lot of success used in that regard, mm-hmm. still used even today to minimize dust exposure.
Effectively, you create a clean air bubble around the worker instead of trying to control the whole area of respirable air.
You basically divert the dust-laden air away from the operator.
Yeah.
So basically, if you have a mining machine, for example, that's driving an entry or a tunnel, you have fresh air coming up to the face, and there's a way to divert the dust-laden air through a so-called Bradis curtain into the exhaust system. Mm. And so while you have fresh air coming into the working area, because of the turbulence and various types of recirculation problems, mm-hmm. If you don't take appropriate precautions, some of that dust can roll back into the operator position. Mm-hmm. But through the use of, again, water sprays as air movers, you can minimize those consequences. Mm-hmm. There was also work on machine-mounted dust scrubbers. Mm-hmm. And while there was progress made in that, you had to have particular caution in terms of recirculation problems and so forth.
Right. And a scrubber just is some kind of, it has an intake for the dirty, polluted air, and it introduces substances that bind with the particulates.
Yeah, typically water.
Typically water.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then can remove it from the system. And then you mentioned earlier that you were dealing with problems of a particular kind of coal dust that's water repellent. Does that mean that water spray would not be as effective for that kind of coal dust?
I'm not sure.
You mentioned water. You had problems with coal dust that was water repellent early on. Or no? Did I get that wrong? Maybe I heard you wrong on that. With the float coal dust.
Oh, float coal dust. So, well, when you have a mining operation, a cutting operation, you generate particles, mm-hmm. and there's two fractions of dust. One is that which is aerodynamically transportable, or so-called float dust, which deals with the dust explosion problem. Mm. And then you have a smaller fraction that is respirable, mm-hmm. That it has the health effect. Mm-hmm. But in either case, people have used water sprays to suppress those particular fractions of dust.
Okay.
One of the other dust control techniques that was evaluated with, depending on the type of coal, with some success, was a water infusion. So they would actually drill holes in the coal face, mm-hmm. and pump water into the coal. Mm-hmm. So when it's mined, it was less prone to produce dust.
Yeah, yeah. I want to switch now to talk about, we've discussed the tremendous achievements of the U.S. Bureau of Mines during the time that you were there. The U.S. Bureau of Mines was shut down, I think, in 1995, and then 1996 it became effective. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that. Can you talk about, from your position, from your perspective, how that transpired, and we'll start with that.
Well, the Bureau of Mines shut down. It was a political decision. It was ostensibly a budget-saving measure. What's interesting is the Bureau of Mines did not go away. The Organic Act of the Bureau of Mines still exists. Mm-hmm. It was effectively closed because no funds were appropriated for the operation of the Bureau of Mines. Mm-hmm. Some of the work that the Bureau of Mines did was taken up by USGS in terms of minerals availability and mineral needs. The health and safety work was taken up by NIOSH, mm-hmm. and there were other parts of the Bureau of Mines that the activity ceased and desist. Particularly, there were five metallurgy research centers that were closed as a result of the shutdown of the Bureau of Mines. Mm.
And that's perhaps the most difficult for the industry, because they were not, those activities weren't shunted somewhere else. They just disappeared.
Say again, please.
The five metallurgy research centers, that you've mentioned that they transferred out the health and safety stuff, some of it at least, to NIOSH, and that some of the mineral availability went to USGS, but the metallurgy research centers, was there any kind of, you know, were you following the arguments that were made about it, or was it just a kind of silent, a silent death of the organization? Who made arguments for the dissolution of the Bureau, and what were the claims? Was it that it was redundant, it didn't serve it served its purpose in the past, but there were these other agencies that could then do the work as well?
Basically the latter.
Yeah.
I should add that some of the environmental work went to the Department of Energy as well.
Right.
Basically this was portrayed, at least from my perspective, as being a budget-cutting measure that you could save lots of money by eliminating the organization. Mm-hmm. And as I said, it didn't effectively actually eliminate the organization. It eliminated the funding for the organization.
Right. You were, in terms of your center, was the budget for the research center healthy until that time, or was there a gradual attenuation of its resources through the 80s?
It was generally pretty stable.
Yeah.
There were some slight decreases, but not huge changes.
Yeah. What was your reaction when you, was the writing on the wall, or was it a surprise? When the news came?
The writing was on the wall for six or 12 months.
Okay, yeah. And so that must have been difficult, I imagine, especially this is something you had invested in for your career, and you'd made these accomplishments with your teams. Was there a transition plan? Did people move from U.S. Bureau of Mines to NIOSH in the health and safety area and so forth?
Actually, it was a two-step transition. When the Bureau was abolished, Pittsburgh Research Center actually reported into the Department of Energy for a period of time. Mm-hmm. Following that, health and safety part of the program went to NIOSH.
Mm-hmm. And you had worked with NIOSH, or had you worked with NIOSH before? I guess you...
Yes, particularly in related to health issues.
Yeah.
Particularly respirable dust, mm-hmm. Diesel issues, diesel fumes and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, there was a collaboration before that.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in research orientation at NIOSH as opposed to the health and safety section of the U.S. Bureau of Mines? It's more all-encompassing, obviously, but...
Well, I've been gone since 97, basically.
Right.
But my sense is that NIOSH has more of a focus on health than they do on safety in terms of the overall program. But
right.
they do address both.
Okay. And you were, I guess, a senior scientist at the Pittsburgh Research Lab under NIOSH from 97 to 2001?
Yeah, basically I was on assignment to the University of Pittsburgh at that point.
Okay.
Still working for NIOSH.
Okay. And you make a transition then to University of Pittsburgh becomes your new home. Can you talk a little bit about that transition?
Sure. So I I went to the University of Pittsburgh again, initially on assignment from NIOSH. Wound up in the chemical and petroleum engineering department, and was working on various types of laboratory and occupational health and safety issues. Designed some new courses, actually got involved in designing a new interactive classroom that was the first of its kind around the area.
Can you talk about that a little bit? And how is it interactive?
Well, basically, both science and engineering tends to be team-based activities these days. And so we basically built a classroom that had team stations, computer facilitated, with the ability of teams to present to the whole class. And it was at the time a first of its kind, but at least in Pitt it's been replicated probably a dozen times at this point. And the it was recognized with a couple of awards as a result of, at the time, being very innovative. It's pretty standard practice now.
That was the SME AIME GEM Award for Science Education? Is that one of them?
No, that's a different subject.
Oh, okay. so you've got multiple awards in the education area.
So the, well, let's come back to that.
Sure, okay, sure.
See, where were we?
Well, we were talking about the interactive classroom and the innovations you developed in education.
So to finish that part of the story, the in 2001, the then chair of the Department of Chemical and Petroleum Engineering was asked to form a research institute on regenerative medicine. And so he asked me to be his executive director, and I said, I'm having fun teaching in chemical engineering. It's also fun to build new organizations. So I continued to teach in chemical engineering and became the executive director of the McGowan Institute for Regenerative Medicine. So it started out as a small group of about 25 scientists and engineers who were interested in basically artificial organ technology. And it's now grown to a group of 230 affiliated faculty members who spend on the order of $50 or $60 million a year on various techniques, both for artificial organ development, tissue engineering, cell-based therapy, and so forth. So it's been an exciting ride and essentially a new career.
Yeah, absolutely. A different domain, and one at least happily that is fairly flush with support, right? It's something that, in contrast to what happened to mining health and safety research. You know, I was curious about, when I looked at your CV, I was curious about this, and I was, regenerative medicine is a departure from from what you had done before.
Right.
And it's something we skated over at the beginning of this session, but you have an MBA. You trained in management from in the after you did, right, pretty much after you did your Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering.
Right.
In 63 you started, and you did I guess while you were working.
That's correct.
Okay, because it was 63 to 67. At Duquesne, you did an MBA.
That's correct.
What did you take from that education into your work as a manager, as a director?
It's an interesting question, because I tell my students today that when I was their age and even going through undergraduate school, I often wonder why they're making me take this or take that. And I can honestly say that every course I was introduced to and took, I've used, and in many cases wished I had a lot more of that tool or this tool. So, you know, both from an undergraduate perspective and from a graduate perspective, I've been able to put those techniques together and apply them in a variety of environments that turned out to be fairly successful.
Do you have a a particular management style that you had when you were, and did that evolve over time, depending on the project?
I typically try to manage by exception. It's important to delegate and empower people to do what they think is relevant and important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to act, I guess, as to, you know, to be the interface with the outside world.
Exactly.
I suppose, you know, when the requests come in, and you talked about when you were executive. Where are we here now? At a senior level, you're a research director at the U.S. Bureau of Mines. And you had a significant staff. You also had to handle the budget requests to Congress. So.
Well, basically, the budget was primarily administered through the Washington headquarters office, but research directors were asked to help participate in budget hearings and that type of thing, to present to Congress and to the administration the proposed work. So, yes, I was involved in that.
Right, right. And was there an element of, what's the word, salesmanship to that, that you had to, when you, is this something you had to pitch, or was it kind of folded into a larger understanding of the importance of the work, and you were kind of reporting on progress?
Yes to all of the above.
Okay. Yeah, sometimes you really had to convince people that this was important work.
Yeah, you basically had to show that there was a need. Show that you had some potential solutions, and when you had a solution, you had to essentially introduce the findings as a result of the commitment and the investment they had made in you up to this point.
Yeah. And the results, this is, mining is today a pretty safe occupation, is it not?
And it's certainly safer than lots of other occupations.
And due in no small part to the efforts of the U.S. Bureau of Mines during those decades.
Well, the Bureau of Mines contributed, companies have contributed, regulatory agencies have contributed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of stakeholders and players.
Right, right, exactly. I wanted to ask you also about your involvement in the organizations, the Society of Mining Engineers, AIME. Can you talk a little bit about the voluntary or voluntaristic part of your career?
Yeah, so maybe a place to start is you mentioned the GEM Award before.
Yeah.
GEM was an acronym for Government, Education, and Mining, and was basically a public awareness, public outreach initiative that has now been become part of the Minerals Education Coalition. I've always been a strong advocate of promoting interest in science, and I've done that both on a national basis through SME, and I've done it on a local basis through the Carnegie Science Center in Pittsburgh. Mm. And so I found lots of interest, lots of opportunities to make people aware of both the opportunities in science, and careers, and also the need for mined materials, minerals, and so forth. And so that was some of my early involvement in the in SME. I became involved in the coal division because my principal area of interest and activity was in coal. I had an opportunity to become part of the SME Foundation, and ultimately became the president of the SME Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Served on the SME Board of Directors, and 2011 became the SME president.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the value of this kind of voluntary work? I mean, it's a theme I've been talking about with a number of folks, but essentially that so much scientific and engineering work depends on the kind of voluntary contributions of folks in the industry. Can you talk about how SME is important to the furtherance of research and in the networks and collaboration of experts and members of the industry?
So first of all, you only get out of it what you put into it.
Yeah.
And so if you want to derive some benefit from an organization, you need to be prepared to contribute and lead where the opportunities present itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as the SME strategic plan says, SME works to be the indispensable resource to minerals professionals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one simple but very illustrative example is OneMind.org, mm-hmm. which I presume you're familiar
yes.
with.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, OneMind now has some 2 million pages of reference material that prior to the formation of this this database with seven participating partners, that information was relatively inaccessible.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from the SME member surveys that deemed as by the membership to be one of the most important resources that SME provides.
Mm-hmm.
SME provides networking. It provides lots of tools and techniques to facilitate the pursuit of individual careers, mm-hmm. and it's certainly been a valuable resource to me.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier with the closure of the Bureau of Mines being political. Some of the folks I've talked to have felt that the mining industry is a bit under the gun these days, that there's a lot of pressure to, especially in the coal industry, to decrease emissions and pressure to close plants down. Can you talk about what the industry is doing and can do to sort of improve the kind of public perception of mining? And how they can manage the challenges that they're facing right now.
So first of all, I think we all need to reflect and appreciate the role of mining in terms of our society, our way of life, economic stability, and national defense. As I presume you know, the cell phone or the PDA that you and I make good use of, and
right.
lots of other people do, it requires 31 different minerals to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just something we take for granted when we use them every day. But without mining and without the minerals, there wouldn't be such a device.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you can extrapolate that to lots of other things that we depend on for electronics and techniques and tools and
mm-hmm.
so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I think there needs to be a continued effort to make people aware of the importance of mining.
Mm-hmm.
Various companies have been some more proactive than others in terms of being good stewards, but I think the industry overall at this point works diligently and hard to be good stewards of the land and to make people aware of the role that they play in our society.
Professor Murphy, I want to thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure.